Comment, how do they spread so quickly into the vocabulary of young people? That's the world linguist Adam Alexic studies. Alexic is the author of the new book, AlgoSpeak, How Social Media is Transforming the Future of Language. He's fascinated by how slang evolves in the digital age and how words born online can take over real-world speech in months or even weeks.
An example is the word unalive, which you can't say kill on TikTok, so many people instead say unalive. And this actually bleeds into offline, and there's kids in middle schools writing essays about Hamlet contemplating unaliving himself. But that's not actually, like, new speak. It's just people finding a new way to express themselves.
What makes unalive so striking is that it's no longer just internet shorthand. It's made its way into classrooms and everyday conversations. He points out how even the most ordinary words carry little cultural jokes if you trace them back far enough.
One of the first words I ever did on my blog that I started in high school was the word sophomore. I really like this one. It comes from the same roots as the word sophisticated and moron in ancient Greek. So the sophomore means wise fool. And that's what I mean when I say I got into it for the fun facts. It's just really cool to see that. But at the same time, it tells you something about how people conceptualize sophomores. There's a little story held within it. It is this age where you think you know everything, and at the same time, you're a little foolish about some things.
Language has always been inventive. Every generation leaves its fingerprints in words, whether it's a centuries-old wise fool or a TikTok slang spreading at record speed. He says platforms like TikTok and Instagram and the algorithms these companies use to shape what users see aren't just reflecting how young people talk, they're actively shaping it.
There's always been, for example, young people identifying with new words as a way to forge their own identity, as a way to differentiate their identity from adults. At the same time, I think algorithms are bringing us these words faster. They're causing the words to form more quickly because they incentivize the creation of echo chambers that then create their own language. And then they open up those echo chambers just enough to allow those words to spread, but they also compound natural human trends. We've always had trends we've always had in groups, but algorithms push that even more.
Slang is nothing new, of course. Every generation coins its own words. But Alexic cautions that calling something millennial or Gen Z slang misses the larger point.
These labels are made up, Gen Z, millennial. The idea of a social generation didn't exist until the early 1900s. And then over time, we begin to think that they're more and more real. And there is no such thing as Gen Z language. In fact, ascribing that label maybe kind of flattens the true stories of where a lot of these words are coming from. In fact, if you go to Wikipedia, you can find pages for Gen Z and Gen Alpha slang. There's no page for millennial slang. There's only a page for 2000 slang. And it's kind of a new thing that we start thinking of slang as such a generational thing. Slang used to be this countercultural kind of phenomenon where it's just not formal language.
And where this slang originates from matters. Alexic points out that today's slang often draws from two main sources, African-American English and online subcultures like the manosphere. That tells us something about power, identity, and who drives what's seen as cool. Another way younger generations communicate? Emojis. Alexic says they're not just fun add-ons, but in this digital age, are words in their own right.
Emojis are words. I can't emphasize that strongly enough. I mean, words come from the increasing abstraction of pictographs, and emojis are just a new pictograph. It's something, you look at it, it holds meaning. That's a word, right? And so just like words, emojis evolve meaning over time. We started out with the laughing, crying emoji to indicate laughter, but among younger people, that became semantically bleached, meaning that it lost its sort of meaning. It became overused and it became thought of as ironic. So then people moved to the crying emoji, and then that got overused, and people moved to the skull emoji, and then that got overused. Now there's like the heartbreak emoji or the wilting rose emoji. So we're constantly cycling between different words depending on the social context, and words really do evolve meanings, as do emojis.
Alexic says that emojis, unlike slang words, have a limited keyboard of options on your smartphone or other device. So how do companies decide which emojis make the cut?
These emojis are being pushed by algorithms as well. The new meanings I was talking about, the wilting rose and the heartbreak emoji and the skull emoji, those were all popularized through algorithmic trends. And it seems like this cycle of moving through different emojis to express irony, that's accelerating. And you see the same thing with other emojis changing meaning. There's a new trend every other week with somebody trying to popularize some emoji or another. But the thing is, these fads die out. Once your grandmother starts saying skibbity or starts using the skull emoji, it's no longer cool and you want to move on.
Slang and emojis can feel ridiculous, even cartoonish. But Alexic argues that it's all part of the cycle. When you look back at phrases like kick the bucket, those might have sounded just as silly once. So what does the future hold for how we speak? Alexic believes that these trends will continue to be driven for many years by social media algorithms and artificial intelligence.
Individual slang words, I don't think skibbity, for example, is going to stay around. Individual slang words do die out because, again, they're tied to meme lifespans. And I strongly believe that they found the most addicting medium to recommend us content. I don't think that'll be going anywhere for a while. So you can pay attention and start seeing the exact same trends with every new word until we find that more addictive medium. And the trends are that there's an in-group that feels like they have a space to use their language. There's a context collapse where somebody reinterprets that in a new setting. And then the words slowly move across these filter bubbles, echo chambers online, are popularized as broad trends, and then are reused by creators because the creators want to tap into a trend. That is a cycle we will continue seeing over and over again until we move on from the algorithm, which I don't think we will for a minute.
He emphasizes that it's not really about the specific slang terms themselves, which will always come and go. As AI continues to expand in use, this technology will play a bigger role in what words rise to the top and become popular in our everyday language.
These algorithms operate on AI. They're run through large language models, and they decide how to recommend content based on deep learning. This is AI. And yes, AI, GPT, that kind of stuff is getting more sophisticated. We're seeing more AI recommended content. We're seeing people start to talk more like ChatGPT. All of this definitely will influence things. I think the algorithms are also going to get more sophisticated. So words like unalive, which are now also censored, they won't last as long either. If anything, AI is going to get better at identifying words in context. It will never be perfect because AI's representation of language is never perfect. But what you'll see is that it will push people to produce more ways to talk about things they want to talk about faster. And if anything, we're going to have more language change going on.
What today's slang really shows us is how deeply technology has threaded itself into culture. Algorithms may feel invisible, but they're steering how we joke, how we connect, and even how we grieve. The story of language is the story of us. And right now, it's being written faster than ever. To learn more about our guest, Adam Alexic, and his book, AlgoSpeak, head to viewpointsradio.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Viewpoints Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and X. This story was written and produced by Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price.
Coming up, the resilient story of one couple lost at sea for 4 months when Viewpoints returns.
$5,000. That's the average amount of money people in the U.S. are now spending on gas in a year. $5,000. That's crazy. If you drive, you have to download Upside, the free app that gives you cash back every time you get gas. That's right. You can earn real cash back with Upside just by buying the gas you're already buying. You can literally start earning cash back today.
I use Upside every time I fill up, and I've already made around $200-$300.
You're putting gas in your car anyway. Why not get real cash back? If you like free money, download Upside.
I'm saving the cash I earn from using Upside to help pay for a vacation later this year.
Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code OWN to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
You know that big bargain detergent jug is 80% water, right? It doesn't clean as well.
80% water? I thought I was getting a better deal because it's so big.
If you want a better clean, Tide Pods are only 12% water. The rest is pure, concentrated cleaning ingredients.
Oh, let me make an announcement.
Attention shoppers, if you want a real deal, try Tide Pods.
Stop paying for watered-down detergents. Pay for clean. If it's gotta be clean, it's gotta be Tide Pods. Water content based on the leading bargain liquid detergent.
Whoa, it's you, the Capital One Bank guy.
That's what they call me.
Mind if I get a selfie?
Yeah, sure thing. Say no fees or minimums on your Capital One checking account.
Wow, that's a keeper. So, where are you heading?
I'm off to spread the good news that Capital One helps people keep more money in their wallet with no overdraft fees.
Oh, you're the best Capital One Bank guy.
Hey, mind if I get a selfie?
Sure.
Say, Capital One, what's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
What makes some people crumble in the face of disaster while others find a way to push through? Psychologists call this trait quality resilience. And while it might sound like something you either have or don't, the truth is more complicated. Resilience doesn't always mean being fearless or unshakable. Sometimes it's a quiet persistence and a will not to give in or give up. Researcher George Bonanno, a professor of clinical psychology at the Teachers College at Columbia University, has been studying and mapping this trait out for more than 35 years.
We find most people are resilient to potentially traumatic events, but we've had a very difficult time until relatively recently making sense of that, understanding how we can determine who will be resilient and who not.
Bonanno is also the author of The End of Trauma, How the New Science of Resilience is Changing How We Think of PTSD.
You know, we've measured many different factors. There's a kind of a common idea that there's three or four magic traits that resilient people have. And you see these sort of headlines, the four qualities of highly resilient people or whatever. But we've measured maybe, you know, my team and other people, other researchers have measured 50, 60, 70 different factors. And we find many, many correlates of resilience. So lots of things correlate with resilience. There are lots of healthy things that we can assume would make us resilient.
For example, you might assume that people who are adaptable, flexible, and optimistic are likely to be more resilient than people who aren't. But Bonanno says these traits don't necessarily predict this. He calls this the resilience paradox.
We can measure all these things, but we still can't predict resilience. So that's led me and my team and other researchers also to develop an alternative way of thinking about these events that involves what I call flexibility, or regulatory flexibility, adaptive flexibility. We may have lots of positive characteristics, but every event is different. Every challenge, every life-threatening, highly aversive, disturbing event is different. It presents us with a different challenge. And so we have to adapt to that event. We have to figure out what's going to work in this situation. And, you know, if you think about it, being in the pandemic, which we all went through recently, was a very different kind of challenge than, say, being in an automobile accident or being in a lost at sea.
Speaking of being lost at sea, in 1972, a British couple, Maurice and Marilyn Bailey, were in this exact position. They spent 4 months in a small rubber life raft on the Pacific Ocean after their sailboat sank. They ran out of food and fresh water after 20 days. So how did they manage to survive for 3 more months?
You press on, right? You meet crisis with pragmatism and with planning rather than with, like, falling apart.
That's Sophie Elmhurst, journalist and author of A Marriage at Sea. It was during the pandemic that she came across this virtually forgotten story about the Baileys. She learned that out of the two, Marilyn Bailey exhibited far more resilience than her husband, Maurice.
To be fair, in Maurice's mind as well, I think he was very quick, both publicly and privately, to sort of say that she kept them alive and that it was thanks to her that they survived. And that was her ingenuity, her pragmatism, her stoicism, but it was also her kind of almost arranged optimism, you know, this sense that she just wasn't going to give up. She would just believe that they would survive. And she had all sorts of sort of strategies to retain that faith.
On the other hand, Maurice, like many of us, felt defeated and like all hope was lost.
I think that's absolutely fair to say that she did the hard job of survival for them both, really. She very quickly was like, right, we need projects, you know. So they had 2 books that they got off their boat before it sank. She was like, right, we'll go through them line by line. We'll discuss every line. You know, she knew it was very important that, you know, there was a physical component, like the fishing, in the water, but there was also this mental component. They needed to keep their minds busy. She had them playing cards that they made out of paper, dominoes that they made as well. And she was constantly you know, planning. I think that was something that really struck me and really struck me from her diary, that you see all these doodles and drawings of dresses she's designing and menus that she's planning and lists of elaborate sort of cakes and sandwiches and drinks and, you know, picnics, occasions that, you know, that she's sort of clearly, you know, almost sort of salivating over in her mind. And partly that's probably due to starvation, but it's also a, I think, is a kind of imaginative exercise of willpower.
Marilyn also jumped into action and adapted the few supplies they'd been able to save. For example, she salvaged a safety pin, bent it into a fishing hook, and was able to catch fish and later sea turtles.
They would eat turtle eyeballs. They've discovered that there was sort of a kind of a gooey kind of juice that came out of the, you know, the eggs from turtles as well, you know, sort of ways of getting, trying to get other kinds of protein or moisture. Anyway, there was sort of, they were nothing if not like, creative, I suppose, in how they found things to eat.
Several ships passed during the couple's 4 months-long ordeal in the small lifeboat, but apparently the people on board didn't see them and sailed right on by. When the seventh ship sailed out of view, Marilyn finally gave in to despair, but only briefly.
There are these brief moments, especially when a ship goes past and doesn't see them, or the weather's very bad, when she'll write something like despair, depressed, no hope, or, you know, it'll be a very brief. The next day, you know, she's back into kind of documenting something or planning something or coming up with some new idea. So you feel like she allows them a very limited, literal amount of space on the page. And it's sort of, I feel like that corresponds to the amount of space she allowed them in her mind in a way.
Maurice freely admitted after they were finally rescued by a Korean fishing ship that he would have never survived had it not been for his partner's ingenuity and optimism. Maybe it was experience that allowed Marilyn to keep calm, regulate her emotions, and adapt to the situation. Traits that Bonanno points to as the core of resilience.
The whole process of development is about learning how we regulate ourselves. And it actually maps very nicely onto this concept of flexibility. And most people actually, at least moderate skill in these different flexibility components and working out, how do I respond to this situation? That said, I think it's very much ripe for people to get better at these skills, to improve in these skills. And I'm doing a lot of research on that right now, on whether we can train people, how we can train people to be more flexible, to better use these skills. It's a very natural human trait already. We are very flexible. We have very flexible brains, but it is how we learn, how we behave in the world. And it really helps us to understand that and perhaps try to do that more effectively.
Bonanno believes we can build resilience early on by introducing kids to challenging events or tasks and allowing them to fail. We learn through our mistakes, and it's in the challenges that we grow. Sophie Elmhurst's book, A Marriage at Sea, and George A. Bonanno's book, The End of Trauma, How the New Science of Resilience is Changing How We Think of PTSD, are available now online and can be requested through your local bookstore. To find out more about our guests this week, visit viewpointsradio.org. This story was written and produced by Polly Hansen. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson. This segment is brought to you by Capital One. Banking with Capital One helps you keep more money in your wallet with no fees or minimums on checking accounts and no overdraft fees. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. Member FDIC.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
$5,000. That's the average amount of money people in the U.S. are now spending on gas in a year. $5,000. That's crazy. If you drive, you have to download Upside, the free app that gives you cash back every time you get gas. That's right. You can earn real cash back with Upside just by buying the gas you're already buying. You can literally start earning cash back today.
I use Upside every time I fill up, and I've already made around $200, $300.
You're putting gas in your car anyway. Why not get real cash back? back. If you like free money, download Upside.
I'm saving the cash I earn from using Upside to help pay for a vacation later this year.
Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code OWN to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
This is Viewpoint Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. If you're lucky enough to have bought gold 20 years ago, you're probably pretty happy right now. Back in the early 2000s, the price per ounce was just under $400. Today, this number sits at just over $3,600 per ounce, according to investment firm America Hartford Gold. The real surprise has been what's happened just in the last year. Since 2024, gold's value has skyrocketed by 55%. So what's driving this modern gold rush? Experts say it's a mix of inflation, global uncertainty, and the rising demand as investors search for safer places to invest than the stock market. Historically speaking, gold is known to be a safe bet when currencies weaken or when interest rates don't keep up with inflation. But here's the real question. With prices so high, does it make sense to buy gold? Financial experts say yes, because it still serves a different purpose than typical investments. It doesn't pay dividends like stocks or interest like bonds. Instead, its main role is stability. Think of it less as a way to get rich and more as an insurance policy if other assets lose value. That said, more experts don't recommend putting a large chunk of your savings into gold. Instead, most suggest keeping just a small slice, anywhere between 5 to 10%. If you've never invested in gold, the simplest route is through exchange-traded funds, or ETFs, funds you can buy and sell like a stock that track the price of gold. With these, you don't have to physically store it yourself. If you do want the actual metal, experts recommend sticking with government mints, established precious metal dealers, or accredited coin shops. These places have transparent pricing and guaranteed authenticity. If you're getting in at today's prices, it's more about long-term protection and not profit. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. Last year, audiences were thrilled by The Substance, a body horror satire that deliriously took on beauty standards and the gold rush of products that promised people, but specifically women, could look younger and more beautiful if only they buy the right stuff. Anchored by star performances from both Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley, The Substance went from a niche horror movie out of Cannes to securing 5 Oscar nominations and 1 win. This year, the movie Him was sold on a similar premise, but for men. Him is a football-adjacent horror movie that follows a young up-and-coming QB who goes to train with a retiring legend. In its long and exciting ad campaign, Him was sold as a horror satire that would explore the pressure our society puts on young men to excel at sports and the crushing weight of an entire city demanding perfection from its athletes. But the actual release of the movie Him was met with a groan and some collective disappointment. Where The Substance was clever and provocative, Him is obvious in one note. It's full of scenes that subvert the audience's expectations with shocking acts of violence, but don't actually take the story anywhere new. Its script is chock full of youthful language, with characters constantly saying things like, "He's the goat," or, "Of course, I'm him." But the script is sorely lacking in any actual insight, or even moments of great dramatic tension. And it's a real shame, because in its somehow overlong 96 minutes, the film does have some bright spots. Lead actor Tyreek Withers is great as the wide-eyed young QB desperate to prove himself. And Julia Fox gives a hammed-up performance that hints at a more fun version of this movie that may have existed at some point in its development. Maybe the movie's biggest strength is in its visual language. Him features a number of sequences that are expertly lit, shot, and edited, including some very cool moments where the camera seemingly snaps into an X-ray visualizer. but maybe the whole thing should have just been a short film or a music video. Despite its promising thematic concerns, the movie Him is a dud. I'm Evan Rook.
$5,000. That's the average amount of money people in the U.S. are now spending on gas in a year. $5,000. That's crazy. If you drive, you have to download Upside, the free app that gives you cash back every time you get gas. That's right. You can earn real cash back with Upside just by buying the gas you're already buying. You can literally start earning cash back today.
I use Upside every time I fill up, and I've already made around $200-$300.
You're putting gas in your car anyway. Why not get real cash back? If you like free money, download Upside.
I'm saving the cash I earn from using Upside to help pay for a vacation later this year.
Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code OWN to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
Step right up. Circus history is alive in Wisconsin.
The circus would come to town and whole cities would shut down. There wouldn't be school. The stores would be closed because everybody would go to the circus.
A big part of the circus, the wagons. And now what's believed to be the last bell wagon anywhere is at Circus World in Baraboo. Commissioned by the Ringlings in 1892, this 10,000-pound rolling musical instrument was the crown jewel of the circus parades.
Those parade wagons, circus parades would have to get people excited to come see the circus. And so those are the very ornamented ones, lots of carving.
That's Jennifer Kronk. She's the curator of history at Circus World. Three other unique wagons owned by Feld Entertainment in Florida are also on loan for the next couple of years. It's a slice of Wisconsin and circus history right here, where you can relive the glory of the parade and echo of the bells calling you to the big top. I'm Terry Barr.
I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. A mix of sun and clouds today, breezy and warm, with a few showers and thunderstorms possible in the afternoon, highs in the upper 70s. A few lingering showers possible tonight, otherwise partly cloudy skies, breezy and turning cooler with lows in the mid-40s. Right now, it's 66 degrees.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Mayan Vasta Betancourt.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, why aren't we better prepared for natural disasters?
It's one of those things where people think, oh, it could happen to you, but it's not going to happen to me. And that is a very dangerous place to exist.
But first, can acupuncture help patients recover from open heart surgery?
We know that heart disease extends well beyond the heart, so I just love it when therapies and treatments address the whole person.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Do Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis symptoms keep coming back? Tremfya, guselkumab, may help, with rapid remission achieved at 12 weeks and lasting clinical remission at 1 year. Some even saw visible improvement of their intestinal lining at 12 weeks and 1 year. Tremfya is a prescription medicine used to treat adults with moderately to severely active Crohn's disease and adults with moderately to severely active ulcerative colitis. Serious allergic reactions and increased risk of infections and liver problems may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection, flu-like symptoms, or if you need a vaccine. Healing is possible with Tremfya. Approximately 3 out of 10 patients were in endoscopic remission at 1 year, based on areas visualized on colonoscopy, which may not represent the deeper bowel layer or entire GI tract. Individual results may vary. Ask your doctor about Tremfya today. Call 1-800-526-7736 to learn more or visit TremfyaRadio.com.
¶¶
100,000 people in the U.S. have a heart attack each year, according to the CDC. About 500,000 undergo open-heart surgery. And while both of these events are terrifying and risky for patients, that's not the end of their journey. Dr. Kim Feingold says patients can often experience significant anxiety and depression that can further stress the heart.
So we know that stress, anxiety, and depression can have negative implications on cardiovascular functioning. We know that their mood is impacted. So 20 to 40% of patients after open heart surgery will experience symptoms of clinical depression. Up to 30% of cardiovascular patients can experience symptoms of clinical anxiety. And we also know that patients can experience symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And then general stress, well, it's not specifically a medical or psychiatric diagnosis, is also very common and can impact cardiovascular functioning.
Feingold is an assistant professor of surgery and psychiatry at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. She says it's not well known why people have an increased risk of clinical depression after a heart attack or surgery. However, the current ongoing research is looking at how physical behaviors factor into this risk.
If patients aren't necessarily able to engage in exercise or activity so much after a heart attack or after heart surgery, but there appears to be a lot of the variance, at least 50% of it, is due to physiological mechanisms. And so whether there is a mechanistic pathway that's related to inflammation or to physiological arousal or sympathetic arousal, there seems to be some physiological reasons why individuals are at increased risk for depression. And also there seems to be similarly physiological reasons why those who develop depression experience worse outcomes and greater risk of cardiac morbidity and even mortality.
Which is why Feingold says it's crucial to educate patients, not just on these statistics, but on the symptoms of depression, so that they can be treated before it leads to something more serious, like death. Feingold's the founder and director of cardiac behavioral medicine at the Bloom Cardiovascular Institute at Northwestern. Part of her job is finding creative methods of treating the whole person instead of just the heart. She recently worked on a pilot study published in Perioperative Management to determine if acupuncture therapy could be one of these integrative treatments. While it hasn't yet been used after open heart surgery, Feingold says there's precedent for its use in helping patients heal after other types of procedures.
Orthopedic surgeries, gynecological surgeries, and has been demonstrated to decrease patients' need for pain medication, improve their experience of pain, and also reduce surgical side effects such as nausea, vomiting, and so forth. So we just thought that altogether there was wonderful opportunity to examine the role of acupuncture in the cardiovascular setting, specifically after cardiovascular surgery.
Anya Grimone was an acupuncturist and Chinese medicine clinician at Northwestern Medicine for 20 years. She says the practice has been around for more than 3,000 years.
It's made its way in 20th century, probably 1970s, it started getting popularized here in the U.S. In Chicago, it was actually legalized in Illinois in 1997, so it's still fairly new over here.
She says that in the beginning of her time at Northwestern, maybe 1% of patient referrals were from physicians. Now she estimates that that number has jumped to 95%. But even with this rise, there's still a lot of skepticism around acupuncture therapy.
We were the best kept secret on campus for quite a few years. There were a lot of physicians, a lot of people who had no idea that we even existed. So it's been a long journey of kind of climbing out of the shadows. Now, where before it was like, this doesn't work, so there was a lot of dismissal. Now, I think the message shifted more towards, I don't know anything about it, it's not going to hurt. So there's a shift. There's still not a resounding, yes, go for it, or promoting it, or advocating for it, but there's less resistance to it.
If you're not familiar with acupuncture, it's often described as energetic medicine. The traditional practice uses the meridian theory, in which needles are used to target microscopic strings called meridians.
They're tiny little microscopic vessels that lie inside your lymphatic system, inside larger blood vessels. They create networks around the organs, and they contain microgranules of DNA.
Modern medicine explains these acupuncture points as groupings of nerve fibers.
So when you stick a needle through, you stimulate these nerve endings into releasing a number of different biochemicals, endorphins, so natural painkillers, vasodilators, so they bring the blood circulation to the area, they regulate your endocrine system, so regulate hormones. So very measurable neuroendocrine effect as to what happens.
However, Gramon says that while these two definitions have a lot of overlap, the main difference can be seen when stimulating a nerve versus a meridian.
When you stimulate a nerve, I know exactly what's going to happen. If I'm going to stimulate your vagus nerve, I'm going to slow down your heart rate. I know what's going to happen. But if you stimulate the same acupuncture point, can increase or decrease heart rate, increase or decrease blood pressure, increase or decrease movement of your intestines, the body somehow knows how to use the stimulus to its best advantage.
Meaning that acupuncture helps your body restore its normal functioning by bringing attention to wherever it's needed in the body, which is different for each patient. Gramon helped bring this practice to Feingold's study, using daily acupuncture on patients who had just had open heart valve surgery. However, the research looked at more than just patient symptoms.
Our primary goal, since acupuncture has never been utilized before in the hospital setting after open heart surgery, is we wanted to assess if this was feasible, right? So are patients willing to accept acupuncture therapy after open heart surgery? We know that they're going through a lot. This is a monumental experience in their life. And is it also logistically feasible in the very fast-paced environment? And then beyond that, we were very interested in looking at the outcomes. Is acupuncture going to have an impact on post-operative pain, nausea, stress, anxiety, the patient experience, as well as medical outcomes, including length of stay and post-operative atrial fibrillation?
Atrial fibrillation is an irregular and often very fast heart rhythm that can lead to blood clots and increased risk of stroke or heart failure. Feingold says about 30% of patients can experience this after surgery, which can lengthen their hospital stay. Patients in Feingold's study received acupuncture the day after their surgery and then each day following until they were discharged. Three licensed acupuncturists, including Gramon, were charged with delivering this therapy.
They came up with the standard protocol that we used for this study that targeted all of the common symptoms that can occur after cardiovascular surgery, including ones related to cardiac rhythms and cardiac functioning, but also things related to pain, depression, anxiety, nausea, vitality, and so forth. So our protocol consisted of about 8 or 9 needles that were placed on the body and in the ear.
And then, because acupuncture is not prescriptive, it's very individualized. We always take into account who's the human in front of us. We would look at what else do they need. And then we would add points depending on if they had anxiety or depression, we would add points for that. If they had pain, we would add points for that. If they had nausea from anesthesia, we would add points for that. So we would modify that protocol by adding things that were necessary.
Even though this is just the beginning of their research, Feingold says that these first results are very exciting. For one, it proved that acupuncture is able to be delivered in such a chaotic environment. Another win was the patient's acceptance of the therapy.
Majority of our patients had no prior experience with acupuncture, indicating or suggesting that they're very open to receiving integrative therapies in this environment. So that was very exciting. Also very exciting is we found that there's significant promise in the role of acupuncture for improving outcomes and patient experience after open heart surgery. And so that was very exciting. Our patients in the acupuncture arm reported less severity of pain, nausea, stress, and anxiety compared to their counterparts who didn't receive acupuncture. They also spent fewer hours in the intensive care unit, about 7 fewer hours compared to those who didn't receive acupuncture.
And then the last, and possibly most important outcome, is that this research suggests that acupuncture therapy could reduce instances of atrial fibrillation after surgery.
So like I said, about a third of patients historically might experience post-operative atrial fibrillation after surgery. And we did find that patients in our standard care experienced a 32.7% incidence of post-operative AFib, but those who experienced daily acupuncture, they had an incidence of 13.7%. So patients who experienced daily acupuncture had a 58% reduction in the incidence of post-operative AFib, which was very exciting. Again, this was a smaller pilot study, but just to appreciate the potential role of acupuncture reducing medical outcomes is remarkable. And we know that heart disease extends well beyond the heart. So I just love it when therapies and treatments address the whole person.
You can find more information about Dr. Kim Feingold, Anya Grimone, and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. This segment originally aired in December 2023. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, how to make mental health resources more effective for disaster survivors when Radio Health Journal returns.
At Charmin, we heard you shouldn't talk about going to the bathroom in public, so we decided to sing about it.
Charmin Ultra Strong. You can use less, better than the rest. Charmin Ultra Strong. Your booty past the clean tech. Yeah. Salmon wave texture, it's the best. Study up, teach a lesson on fresh. Your booty past the clean tech.
Yes, sir.
Charmin Ultra Strong.
Charmin Ultra Strong with diamond weave texture cleans better than the leading one-ply brand, so you can use less. Enjoy the go with Charmin.
Progressive's AutoQuote Explorer lets you easily compare direct rates from different insurance companies, so you can be confident you're getting the right one, even if it's not with Progressive. Way more confident than you were when you tried online gaming. Who knew 12-year-old boys could be so mean? And where did they learn to swear like that? 2 hours of losing to these underage trash talkers, and you're starting to question if maybe you really should stick to pickleball and other boomer stuff. So use Progressive's AutoQuote Explorer and be confident you're getting insurance that's right for you. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Between the wildfires in Southern California and the flash flooding at Camp Mystic in Texas, America has experienced truly devastating weather events this year. But even though we see some of these extreme incidents every year, Alexis Murgenoff says that oftentimes local and state officials are still unprepared when tragedy strikes. She feels this disconnect stems from a sense of disbelief that such destruction would actually happen in their area.
It's one of those things where people think, oh, it could happen to you, but it's not going to happen to me. And that is a very dangerous place to exist. It's also something that I think that we do for ourselves to offer some sort of mental health protection, you know, because we can't be walking around thinking all day, every day, what's the worst case scenario that's going to happen.
But we do need people in place who are dedicated to preparing for tragedy. Murgenoff is an assistant professor of social and behavioral sciences at New York University's School of Global Public Health. She specializes in how natural hazards affect the health of communities and says that we can see this ignorance unfortunately play out with the flooding in Texas earlier this year.
That's an area that floods frequently. People perhaps became complacent that the flooding occurs, but nobody thinks it's going to be that bad. And it happens in Florida. We get hurricanes all the time. I've lived through a ton of them. It's never going to be that bad or the one. But then the one happens. And so I think that is the disconnect, is that people understand that this is a possibility, but they're not preparing for worst case scenario.
America does have national guidelines that discuss five factors, including prevention, protection, mitigation, response, and recovery. However, Murgenoff says there isn't the same comprehensive framework that targets mental health recovery.
Disaster recovery often uses what some researchers call as fantasy documents. You know, we have plans, we know what we're supposed to do. People put in a lot of work to coming up with different programs, stages, but when it actually comes to the disaster itself, those plans can kind of be shelved or put in a drawer and not really referenced.
Or if they are, it's very possible the plans are out of date.
One of the challenges is that disasters, we don't know when they're coming, right? So sometimes we might plan for the next pandemic, but then the next pandemic doesn't come for 10, 15 years, and the plans are outdated.
The good news is that Murgenoff and other researchers have been analyzing past disasters to see where mental health recovery programs can be better. One tactic she's happy to see being utilized is having open communication between states to workshop the most effective approach together.
So I'll give an example from Hurricane Sandy, which I think was an excellent thing that a lot of the state health officials did. Was they said, okay, our state is dealing with a disaster that's unprecedented. We haven't experienced this in New Jersey before. It wasn't that long after Katrina. And so what they did was they went to officials in Louisiana and Mississippi who had dealt with Katrina recovery and said, what do you think our population might need? And to hear that from people who had already lived through it and could say, hey, this is what worked. This is what didn't work. This is what we should have done. Here were some of the gaps. And then the New Jersey officials could come together and say, okay, this is what we know. And we know our population and who we need to be serving. And these are the kinds of programs that we need to put in place.
And though they worked hard to provide effective mental health programs, Murchinoff says one of the biggest challenges is timing. Oftentimes, people aren't ready to address their internal struggles until well after the rest of their lives are put back together after a disaster.
They will initially try to get housing, try to make sure their kids are in school. If they're looking for employment, if they need to maintain employment, right? They're dealing with those more immediate needs. And then maybe 3 months, 6 months, a year later, when they're sitting in some relative normalcy, they'll say, oh my gosh, I'm actually experiencing some sort of anxiety. I'm a little depressed. I'm not sleeping well. And they need those services, but all the programming has come to an end.
She says that in many recovery cases, the funding is set up to provide all services up front. However, she argues that the mental health services need to be restructured to be available when the community actually needs them.
A lot of it is set up for that 3 to 6 month period after an event occurs. And if I have learned anything over researching these events the last 15 years, is that that is not sufficient. We need programming that can last for years, essentially. It could be that people only need help for a few weeks. They could need help for a few months, but it could be a year or two or three. And it depends, again, on the severity of the event, the type of event, where it occurs. But a lot of these recovery programs are kind of front-loaded to immediately following a disaster.
Unfortunately, the physical and mental recovery takes a long time. It's an ongoing process that works at its own pace. Because of this, Murchinoff believes that if there's only enough funding for a few months of mental health programming, they should start later in the revival process, depending on the community's needs.
An event where people are trying to get their housing together, they're trying to get their kids in school, you know, regain some sense of normalcy, and then it's, oh, I need to tend to myself and my mental health. And that is way further down the line. So if we know that that's the case, can we push the mental health recovery programming maybe 6 months out if we don't have sufficient funds to let those programs run for a year or two?
Having good mental health is such an important aspect of resiliency. In Murchinoff's research, she's seen how populations with high resiliency tend to recover faster and come back stronger as a group.
And we've seen that a lot with Katrina, with Sandy, when you're thinking about communities that were able to recover at a faster rate. It's because they had this social cohesion in place.
But in order to have this strength in the face of tragedy, she says that it needs to be fostered before disaster even occurs.
And by that, I mean strengthening ties and cohesion among community members so that when a disaster happens, people already have relationships in place that they can turn to when it comes to recovery. A lot of the knowledge that you need in order to recover, whether it's figuring out how to deal with insurance providers, knowing where to get hot meals, finding out that you're maybe eligible for some program that you hadn't heard about, that's a lot of informal knowledge sharing. And you get that from other people who are going through the same disaster.
Murchinoff says this strong community can be achieved through investing in social infrastructure, like libraries and organizations where people can meet each other.
Doing that ahead of time, investing in that way, which may not necessarily be tagged as disaster preparedness, it's really community building, but it serves multiple purposes. And I think the return on investment is pretty good because it helps not only with recovery, but it helps with health, it helps with mental well-being, it helps with knowledge sharing. And people are happier when they're actually out interacting with each other. So I would like to see greater funding given to social infrastructure. I'm not saying don't invest in physical infrastructure, but can we put a little bit more into the social side of things where we know long-term that there are really high payoffs?
You can find more information about Alexis Mergenhoff and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Greg Johnson.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem. Over a 3-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin, and over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. Stroke risk may increase. Eliquis can cause serious and potentially fatal bleeding. Don't take if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or bleed longer. A spinal injection increases blood clot risk, which may cause paralysis. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding or bruising, or back pain, tingling, numbness, muscle weakness, or incontinence. Aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
Whoa, it's you, the Capital One Bank guy.
That's what they call me.
Mind if I get a selfie?
Yeah, sure thing. Say no fees or minimums on your Capital One checking account.
Wow, that's a keeper. So, where are you heading?
I'm off to spread the good news that Capital One helps people keep more money in their wallet with no overdraft fees.
Oh, you're the best Capital One Bank guy.
Hey, mind if I get a selfie?
Sure.
Say, Capital One, what's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
You know that big bargain detergent jug is 80% water, right? It doesn't clean as well.
80% water? I thought I was getting a better deal because it's so big.
If you want a better clean, Tide Pods are only 12% water. The rest is pure, concentrated cleaning ingredients.
Oh, let me make an announcement.
Attention shoppers, if you want a real deal, try Tide Pods.
Stop paying for watered-down detergents. Pay for clean. If it's got to be clean, it's got to be Tide Pods. Water content based on the leading bargain liquid detergent.
Medical notes this week. Could birth control be affecting your brain? Millions of women use hormonal contraception, and new research is showing it may be affecting more than reproduction. Research in the journal Hormones and Behavior shows that contraceptives seem to affect brain processes that are responsible for emotions and memory. The paper has connected that birth control appears to influence how women experience emotions and remember the emotional event later. You'll never guess this sneaky cause of air pollution. Though wildfires and dust storms aren't great for our health, droughts are a main driver of the polluted environment in Latin America. Nearly half of electricity is supplied through hydropower, but when there's not enough steady river flow, these areas are forced to switch to fossil fuel. These processes release harmful particles that lead to heart disease and breathing issues. The research is published in the journal Nature Communications. Is inflammation ever helpful? Though it's often the cause of various diseases, a study published in Cell Reports shows that inflammation can be protective in the brain. Scientists found that a molecule called STING, which aids inflammation, may be necessary to keep the brain healthy as we age. However, it's a finding that contradicts earlier research saying that STING needs to be blocked in order to treat age-related brain decline. And finally, are you eating the right type of protein? Consuming protein after a workout is important for muscle recovery, but new research shows that the type of protein matters too. The study, published in the journal Nutrients, reveals that pork-based protein is better for your body than vegetarian alternatives that don't have as many amino acids. And that's Medical Notes this week. I'm Mayan Vastabetancourt.
Dude, did you order
the new iPhone 17 Pro? Got it from Verizon, the best 5G network in America. I've never looked so good.
You look the same.
But with this camera, everything looks better, especially me.
You haven't changed your hair in 15 years. Selfies?
Check, please.
New and existing customers can get the new iPhone 17 Pro, designed to be the most powerful iPhone ever. With eligible phone trade-in and unlimited ultimate, any condition guaranteed. Best 5G source root metrics data, United States, 1H2025. All rights reserved, trade-in and additional terms apply for all offers. See Verizon.com for details.
Progressive knows we all crave validation.
Girl, you are not 37.
I would have guessed 27.
You guys are too sweet.
Sure. Dewy skin.
Terrific. Is something wrong, Ned?
Why would you ask? Just because today marks my 10th anniversary without a car accident or even a speeding ticket? But somehow, tonight's all about your skincare.
Wow. With Snapshot from Progressive, you can get a personalized rate based on how you drive. And that's all the validation you need. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Snapshot not available in California from all agents. Surcharge possible for unsafe driving.
Thank you for joining us this week and every week as we break down the science stories you need to know. You can find all of our past segments and guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and X for daily content. And tune in next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.
Like a long walk through the woods on a sunny day, this is Trail Mix 103.1.
12 years and my life is still trying to get up that creepy hill of hope for a destination.
You're listening to 103.1 FM and 980 AM WPFP Park Falls. This is Trail Mix 103.1.